The clock hour comes from Cronin's Golf Resort, proudly supporting NCPR year-round as a service to the community. Cronin'sGolfResort.com. And from the Adirondack Explorer magazine and Adirondack Almanac, providing regional news and commentary. Also available online at AdirondackExplorer.org and AdirondackAlmanac.com.
This is North Country Public Radio. It's 5 minutes past eight on this Thursday, January 14th. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. The North Country figures to play a big and maybe controversial role in Governor Cuomo's renewable energy plan. We'll hear more on that in just a minute. But first, we're going to start with a national focus.
Vice President Mike Pence will visit Fort Drum near Watertown Sunday. It will be his second visit there in 3 years. It comes days before he and President Donald Trump leave office on January 20th. According to Representative Elise Stefanik's office, Pence will thank members of the 10th Mountain Division stationed there for their service. Many troops have recently returned from deployment to Afghanistan. Stefanik, a Republican, called the visit an honor. She said in a statement, quote, "I express my sincere gratitude to Vice President Pence and the entire Trump administration for their unwavering commitment over the past 4 years," unquote. The visit comes less than 2 weeks after a mob of Trump supporters attacked the U.S. Capitol. Some called for violence against Pence after he refused Trump's calls to deny certification of the 2020 election. Pence and President Trump himself visited Fort Drum during the summer of 2018.
And as expected, Stefanik voted against impeaching President Trump yesterday. The single article of impeachment saying Trump instigated an insurrection against the U.S. government passed the House 232 to 197. In a statement, she called Trump's second impeachment, quote, "a partisan ploy with no basis in the Constitution." Stefanik did not speak against the article during the House debate. Stefanik has stood by Trump since the attack on the Capitol last week, even as top Republicans have been distancing themselves from him or condemning his actions and words.
Large companies have started suspending political donations to members of Congress, including Stefanik, who objected to the certification of the 2020 election last week. Stefanik objected to certifying the vote in Pennsylvania. Emma Jacobs has more.
The companies who've said their political action committees will suspend campaign contributions include donors whose PACs, taken together, gave more than $50,000 to Congresswoman Elise Stefanik during her 2020 race. They include Blue Cross Blue Shield, Comcast, Walmart, Verizon, Intel, American Express, and Best Buy. Plus the business group, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, its PACs gave Stefanik $5,000. Other companies have paused all political giving, including Google and United Health. Each donated $10,000 to Stefanik's last campaign. Politicians don't normally raise a lot of money in the months just after an election. That's according to Sarah Briner, Director of Research and Strategy of the Center for Responsive Politics. It runs the campaign finance website Open Secrets. But she says PACs often give early in the election cycle, providing seed money for the next race.
If you're a House member, not receiving $10,000, you know, doesn't sound like it's going to be that critical, but it's exactly the kind of money that they would be most reliant on in the first and second quarter of a off year.
Briner says individual wealthy donors may step up to replace the lost funds, but she says that the wave of announcements from the business community is unprecedented. She adds that it remains to be seen how long companies' resolve will last and what impact, if any, their decisions will have on the stances of congressional Republicans.
A lot of this depends on public opinion and depends on what happens to the specific members' fundraising and campaigning activities.
Briner says Stefanik does get a lot of PAC donations, so the movement could impact her campaign in 2022. Alex DeGrasse, a senior advisor for Stefanik's political campaigns, wrote by email that, quote, "the majority of the campaign's funding comes from small dollar donors." He said that, quote, "Elise for Congress has $2 million in the bank and her reelection campaign has never been in a stronger position politically." Emma Jacobs, North Country Public Radio.
The number of coronavirus cases continues to soar in the North Country. The region's 10 counties reported almost 500 new cases yesterday, led by Jefferson County with 97. Three more people died in Jefferson County, three more in St. Lawrence County, and one more in Washington County.
Warren County is now reporting five cases of the more aggressive variant of COVID-19, first identified in the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, county health departments are scrambling to help distribute vaccines. Clinton County is hoping to have a drive-through vaccination site running by next week. It would be run by the State Department of Health and will have a goal of administering up to 1,000 vaccine doses a day.
And while most of the focus of fighting the pandemic has fallen on vaccine development and distribution, there's also a need to treat the disease. Even after the vaccine is widely available, the coronavirus will still be around. And medical researchers are trying to tackle both. And some of that research is happening in St. Lawrence County. Julia Ritchie reports.
Dr. Ayal Kadar wears a lot of different hats these days during the pandemic. He's a rheumatologist for the St. Lawrence Health System, first and foremost, and has been treating COVID-19 patients who are hospitalized.
I also am the principal investigator for a number of COVID-19 clinical trials for the St. Lawrence Health System as well.
And as principal investigator, Kadar is currently performing clinical trials with people who have COVID-19 in St. Lawrence County. He's testing various drugs to see if they help keep those patients out of the hospital. He says right now there are very few medications for people hospitalized with COVID-19 and even fewer for less sick patients.
But if you take people at the other end of the spectrum who've been diagnosed, are maybe asymptomatic or lightly symptomatic, and you really want to prevent them from getting into the hospital, from progressing to severe disease, we have nothing.
That's where Kadar's research with something called Active 2 comes in.
And so what Active 2 is doing is that studying a number of what are called antibody cocktails, groups of antibodies that target a protein on the SARS-CoV-2 virus called the spike protein. And it's the protein that the virus uses to gain entry to our cells. And it's a really key protein to target.
Antibodies team up to prevent the protein from latching onto our cells. Carly Lovelett is a manager of the Clinical Research Department, which has been around for 5 years. She says the research is part of the federal government's massive public-private partnership to fight the virus known as Operation Warp Speed. Lovelett says there are about 80 research sites with 110 participants in this second phase of Active 2, some of which are St. Lawrence County residents. Only half the group will receive actual treatment. The others will receive a placebo.
And then once that pivotal phase two is completed, assuming that the data is continuing to support that this is a good treatment for COVID and a safe treatment for COVID, then in phase three, you open it up to a larger population and you're testing the safety and then really testing the prevention of hospitalization and death.
While vaccine development has been the highest priority of most researchers, Kadar says treatments are just as important to the overall response to the pandemic.
We can't rely on vaccines alone to get us through this pandemic. There are going to be people who do not get immunized. There'll be people who do get immunized who still get disease.
Kadar underscores that this type of research is a big deal for this area.
It's actually really unheard of for there to be clinical research sites like ours in most rural areas.
He says there's a lot of reasons to do more of this type of research in rural pockets.
One of the biggest ones is that if you don't involve rural communities in research, you get a big care gap. Now, there's already a big care gap in rural America. By that, I mean people in rural America are largely sicker than people in non-rural parts of America.
That's because people in rural America have less access to medical care due to a shortage of providers and facilities. But there's another reason, too.
It's not just that you're closing a care gap. It's that you're giving people hope. You're giving them a sense that what we're doing here is on par with what is being done everywhere else. And it's actually really important for patients to feel like they're in a place which is on par, especially in such a dangerous and scary time as the COVID-19 pandemic.
Kadar says he's also hopeful that the more people who learn about the important research taking place in the North Country, the higher degree of trust they'll have to eventually get the vaccine when it becomes available. Julia Ritchie, North Country Public Radio.
You're listening to the 8 o'clock hour here on North Country Public Radio. It's 8:15. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. Just ahead, Pendragon Theater in Saranac Lake got a shout out from Governor Cuomo in Tuesday's State of the State speech. Cuomo wants to revive the arts in New York this year. And we'll talk with Pendragon's leadership. That's coming up in just a few minutes, right here on the 8 o'clock hour.
This hour's programming is supported by Gray & Gray & Associates, CPAs, a proactive accounting and financial services firm in northern New York, with offices in Canton and Messina, graycpas.com. And by Renew Architecture and Design, offering custom design services from the St. Lawrence River Valley to the Adirondacks. More at renewarchitecture.com. Music by I Am Snow Angel in Lake Placid.
The North Country figures to play a big and possibly controversial role in Governor Andrew Cuomo's green energy agenda he laid out in a State of the State speech yesterday.
We can establish ourselves as the nation's leader for renewable energy, innovation, and production. And we will secure the jobs of the future right here at home for New Yorkers. A true transformation to a green economy.
Cuomo announced plans for 100 new large-scale renewable projects, many of which are already underway, so New York can reduce its reliance on fossil fuels that cause climate change. They include a new wind project in Lewis County and new solar installations in Washington and Franklin counties.
Cuomo also said the state will need new high-tech transmission lines from the Canadian border near Plattsburgh and from Messina to get that power to New York City. He acknowledged that those have been controversial.
Building transmission capacity is not as easy as it sounds, and it has historically been the single greatest stumbling block. These obstacles may have been too much to take on yesterday, but today's a new day, and what was impossible yesterday is a necessity today.
Cuomo also mentioned upgrading a major power line in St. Lawrence County. He said the state would also invest in workforce development to train people for green energy jobs and manufacturing.
Cuomo also proposed renewable energy projects elsewhere in New York. From Albany, Karen DeWitt puts the North Country's projects in a statewide context.
Cuomo says $26 billion will be spent in public-private partnerships on 100 projects, including new solar energy farms in Saratoga, Cortland, Livingston, and Lewis counties, and the building of two major offshore wind farms with 90 turbines each off of Long Island.
They'll be located more than 20 miles off Jones Beach and located more than 60 miles off Montauk Point, respectively. Don't worry, neither will be visible from the shore. They will provide about 2,500 megawatts. This is the largest production of renewable energy by any state in the United States history.
In addition, the Port of Albany will become a center for manufacturing the wind towers to be used at the offshore sites, and existing facilities in Brooklyn will be beefed up. To move all of that power around, Cuomo says he's opening a competitive bidding process for three projects involving hundreds of miles of new or strengthened transmission lines. They include two along the entire length of eastern New York that would bring Canadian hydropower through the North Country, the Capital Region, and the Hudson Valley to New York City, where the demand for energy is greatest. A third would run the length of the Hudson Valley, and 26 miles would be added in western New York to distribute power more efficiently from the hydropower dam in Niagara Falls.
All of these projects will break the congestion, open the grid, and all of these projects will break ground this year.
It's the second time in his decade as governor that Cuomo has proposed major green energy projects. His first attempt, a solar panel factory at a former steel plant in Lackawanna in western New York, known as the Buffalo Billion, did not work out as planned. A state controller's report in August found that the project is yet to produce the hundreds of jobs initially promised, and that Empire State Development, in charge of the project, managed it poorly. Scandals related to the Buffalo Billion resulted in prison sentences for several involved, including the governor's former closest aide and the former head of SUNY Polytechnic Institute, as well as a Buffalo area developer. Environmental groups praise the new initiatives. In a statement, NYPERG's Liz Moran says the governor is right that global warming poses an existential threat, but she urges Cuomo to go further and eliminate tax subsidies for the fossil fuel industry. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Pendragon Theater in Saranac Lake got a morale boost this week when Governor Cuomo mentioned the Adirondack Theater in his State of the State speech on Tuesday. Cuomo said New York would begin a series of interim steps to help bring back some arts and cultural events next month and put more unemployed artists, actors, and musicians back to work this year. The governor announced a public-private partnership called New York Arts Revival, which will work with the Mellon Foundation to distribute grants to community arts groups.
More than 150 world-class artists, along with arts organizations such as the Ballet Hispanico, Ars Nova, the Albany Symphony Orchestra, the National Black Theater, Pendragon Theater in Saranac Lake, and many others.
Well, many of the details of the governor's New York Arts Revival initiative are still being worked out by the State Council on the Arts. The staff and board at Pendragon are excited at the prospect of offering live theater again later this year. Like most theaters around the country, Pendragon had to furlough some staff members and temporarily halt operations due to the financial hardship brought on by the coronavirus pandemic. I spoke with Pendragon's artistic director, Kim Bouchard, and board president, Lonnie Ford, who say there's a lot of work to be done, but the governor's announcement is good news.
We have been struggling, but we've always talked about a light at the end of the tunnel. And this is a real beacon. So we're thankful. We're thankful to Governor Cuomo. We are thankful to everyone who is working hard to reopen the economy in general and to put performing artists back to work. So this is wonderful news.
Absolutely. This initiative, the New York Arts Revival, as the governor has called it, is such a boost for the arts. And I think, as he mentioned, for the economy, the arts in New York, the number of cultural organizations, he mentioned the thousands that New York State Council on the Arts works with and does such an amazing job of supporting and advocating for this important part of the economy of the state of New York that both brings in people, but also sustains our communities too. I think that's a wonderful thing about our arts communities. And this announcement just felt like, it's hard to describe the kind of exhilaration, the kind of boost that it gave, I think, many of our spirits across the state.
Give me a little bit maybe of a timeline, I guess. I think you folks are going to be meeting later this spring to sort of assess where you go from here. And I'm wondering, is it too soon maybe to comment on that? Or, you know, what do you see as kind of your priorities for 2021?
It's a bit early. Details probably are being fleshed out even as we speak as far as what the initiative really entails. For Pendragon specifically, our priorities are to prepare. We have had an austerity budget at the beginning of the year and had to furlough some staff. This gives us an opportunity to re-examine our actions and to understand what we can do to basically get Pendragon ready to deliver. Pendragon will be back. We are back. We are prepared to take up the banner of our mission again, and we're very excited to see what's next and get back to work. So that's our priority at this point.
at this point, it is an opportunity for us to sit back. We've got a bunch of work to do because right now we also are able to tap into some of the relief bill money that's come through the last COVID relief bill. We need to figure out where we are in terms of that. So we've got a lot of our own just sitting back and reflecting, as well as being ready and being proactive to engage in ways that are going to really serve our communities. So, yeah, we won't be just sitting on our seats waiting, but we will be really taking this time to begin, as Lonnie said very well, prepare. How do we prepare?
Kim Bouchard is artistic director at the Pendragon Theater in Saranac Lake. We also heard from Lonnie Ford, the theater's board president.
You're listening to the 8 o'clock hour here on North Country Public Radio. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. We've got natural selections in just a minute. After that, stick around for Bird Note coming up. Environmental conditions shape birds' bodies like terns. But first, we do have natural selections right here on North Country Public Radio.
Let's revisit a question we talked about, I think now we could say decades ago. And that is, why is the sky blue? Now, you have been trying to explain this to me. Walk me through it one more time.
All right.
It's not reflections. I know that. It's not reflecting off the water. That's right. Just not happening.
And it's not always blue, right?
Well, right. Sometimes I was going to point that out later, but go ahead.
White looking or gray, mm-hmm. or other colors.
Well, let's start with that nice blue, that, you know, corticorum blue sky.
Yeah. Like a young friend of mine once said, it's when the clouds are far apart.
Really
is
far
the
apart.
Kind of day I like.
Yeah.
Okay, so you got the blue sky up there, and from below it looks like maybe a hard ceiling or something, like people would have said in the old days. And it's really a kind of a neat process, and it happens because the air is made of atoms and molecules, and it's because the atoms and the molecules are very small in an exact, precise size. And that's the trick, which is really, like, why would that have anything to do with it? And Albert Einstein worked on this problem, actually, when he was working out how atoms work and how big they are and how they vibrate and things like that. And it's basically the air is mostly nitrogen atoms stuck together into little nitrogen gas molecules and little oxygens, and they're very, very small. And they vibrate all the time. Just having a little warmth in the air or whatever just makes them twitch.
Uh-huh.
And shimmer. And it's because they're a certain size, they twitch and shimmer at just a certain speed or a certain rate.
Frequency.
A frequency.
Say.
Like a guitar string. You pluck a C note and it vibrates at a certain frequency.
Uh-huh.
And then you shorten it a little bit maybe and hits a higher frequency and things like that.
Well, we hear that pitch. We know what that is.
You can hear the pitch, and you know it's... And if you play the instrument, let's say, you know it's dependent on how long the string is. Same thing with these colors. You can tell by the way the light interacts with colors how big the things are it's bouncing off of in this case. And to make the long story short, when sunlight hits the little molecules in the air, the blue light that's embedded in that from the colors of the rainbow, mm-hmm. which are all in there in the sunlight, when the blue light comes in, it's vibrating at pretty much the same speed as the little molecules in the air. And so when a little bit of blue light hits them, it's like they're, oh, I speak your language. And it gives it energy to keep doing what it's doing. It vibrates harder, and it turns into basically a little blue light bulb.
No kidding.
Little nitrogen molecule and each little oxygen molecule in the air takes that blue light, holds it for a while, vibrates, and then bursts it out in all directions as blue light again.
So I'm guessing that when we have a really, really, really deep, that clear blue sky, there's just not much between us and those little tiny vibrating nitrogen gas bubbles.
It's
all coming right at us.
Yeah, there's not a lot of dust or other things scattering, complicating it. The richer the blue is, the cleaner the air, but it's still full of these little molecules in there.
Yeah.
So when the sunlight comes in, it basically lights them up, and they're glowing up there, which is why it's blue like that.
What a cool idea. So what about when it's not really that blue? I mean, obviously, cloudy days, it's not going to be blue. But sometimes on those clear days, and you look off toward the horizon, and it fades. Or what about sunset? Hmm. I mean, it's still, like, what's happening? Is it still those molecules vibrating?
Actually, it's really complicated. There are, like, many processes going on with these different color things. But just take, for example, we were saying sometimes the sky looks gray, you know. And even without the clouds, let's say, it's just a hazy day, let's say. Why does it look gray all of a sudden? And what we're getting there is there's other stuff floating in the air besides those little molecules. There are other things like water droplets, let's say, and they're bigger than the individual little molecules.
So are they kind of blocking the blue?
They're sort of blocking the blue, but what they're really doing is they're so big compared to those little things that the vibrations aren't even in the picture anymore.
Uh-huh.
These things are, if you could blow up just one of those little specks of water moisture up in the air on a hazy day, you could magnify it. It would look kind of like a raindrop. It would look like a blob of shiny water. And that's exactly what it is. It's a shiny little mirror. Mm-hmm. And when the sunlight hits it, all of the colors bounce off it. So it still looks white.
And
now you got all these little white reflecting spherical mirrors up there, mm-hmm. scattering white light in every direction. The sky looks kind of white now.
And it's kind of diluting the blue.
Diluting. It's like everything's up there, and it'll just look like regular sunlight instead of sort of selectively amplifying what the blue is doing like the little molecules do.
And Einstein figured this blue thing out?
He figured out how the sizes of the molecules are related to their little motions like that, which was the foundation for why the sky is blue.
Thanks very much, Dr. Kurt Steger of Paul Smith College, and I'm Martha Foley at St. Lawrence University.
Natural Selections is produced by North Country Public Radio with natural sounds by Ted Mack. The program is underwritten by Paul Smiths, the College of the Adirondacks, 800-421-2605.
It's 8:31, and Natural's broadcast of Natural Selections is supported by the Animal Clinic of Malone and Dr. Stuart Stevens, 518-483-9080 for canine or feline appointments. New pets welcome, open Monday through Friday. And by the Glenn and Carol Pearsall Adirondack Foundation, dedicated to improving the quality of life for year-round residents of the Adirondack Park. PearsallFoundation.org. We're going to bring you a bird note coming up in just about 7 or 8 minutes. We'll bring that to you at 8:42 this morning. We're running a little short on time during the show. We had a lot of news.
There's so many important stories today.
Big news morning.
It's a good problem to have.
Yeah, well, really. I want to just mention a couple of things happening around our region. The Snowtown Film Festival, the show does go on for the Snowtown Film Festival. They're going virtual for their 7th annual event. 50-plus films. And it's coming up the weekend, actually from January 29th through February 7th. And you'll be able to watch the films and panel conversations. And North Country native Richard Grieco is going to be hosting a Q&A discussion on coming up about the film If Looks Could Kill on Saturday, January 30th. So if you want more information, check out the details, and you can get your pass for the online event, snowtownfilmfestival.com, and they're based in Watertown.
And coming up, not this Thursday today, but next Thursday, tune in for singer-songwriter Sean Stoddard, who's the frontman for the Backwater Blues Band. He'll be playing a variety of acoustic music in all with a blues twist, in a Facebook Live event sponsored by Pickens Hall. This is part of their Odd Thursdays at Pickens Opera Hall series, and that's next Thursday at 7 p.m. in a virtual Facebook Live performance. So be sure to check it out.
That is the show for this morning.
Is that the show for the day? I guess that is it. Don't forget, Morning Edition does continue after this, and then you can get all the morning's business news coming up between 8:51 and 9 o'clock with the Marketplace Morning Report. Until tomorrow, I'm Monica Sandreski.
And I'm Todd Moe. Thanks for joining us.